The civil rights struggles of the 1950s and 60s led to landmark legislation changing the way we treated non-white Americans, or did in theory. The actual change did not happen overnight, and anybody who thought the struggle for equality was long ago got a wake-up call when a black man moved into the White House. Today's guest grew up in the latter days of the civil rights campaigns. She grew up in South Carolina and New York City and shares her memoir with us in verse. The book is called Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. Jacqueline Woodson has won many awards for her writing for young adults and younger readers. The also by in Brown Girl Dreaming lists 17 other books, including Hush, Locomotion, After Tupac and Dee Foster, and Beneath a Meth Moon. Brown Girl Dreaming is a 2014 National Book Award finalist in young people's literature. Jacqueline Woodson, very glad to have you on the Jefferson Exchange today.
Thanks for having me. It's good to be here.
You could easily have made this a prose memoir. Why poetry instead?
Because it's about memory, and memory doesn't tend to come to us in prose. It comes fragmented with all of this white space around it, and I wanted to stay true to that.
And very effective, I find, that the poems are not terribly long, but gripping. I mean, in the sense that you're giving us just enough of a taste of each scene to make it stand up.
Oh, thank you. That was my hope.
Memory is strange, you write in the author's note. So how did you send yourself back in time, in essence, to do the work of getting the material you needed for writing the poems?
Well, I think the first thing is I never left it. I never left that space. I think we compartmentalize, but I think what we've experienced doesn't go away. And because I write for young people, there's a lot of the past that I hang on to because I have to access it to be able to go back to that place of being 11, 12, 15, 16 in order to make it sound true to my readers. And in terms of my childhood, there is so much that felt compelling. And because from a really young age, I wanted to be a writer, I was constantly listening and thinking and listening and repeating. And that's how memory becomes a part of who you are.
So you had wanted to be a writer for a very long time. I mean, have you been writing pretty much since school days?
I've known I wanted to be a writer since I was seven, and yes, I have been writing a long time. I mean, that's what Brown Girl Dreaming talks about, is that coming of age during that period as a writer. And a writer is someone who is watching and paying attention and being kind of hyper aware of their surroundings.
I've heard that from so many writers. We've talked to a bunch here on the program, and just the fact that they're people who, they're very observant. I mean, the kinds of detail that you get in poetry and in good writing indicates that people notice little things. They notice little details, the dust behind the door, you know, the shoe that looks a little more scuffed than it was last week, stuff like that.
It's true. We make hard people to be in relationships with.
So does a criticism come in relationships as well? Hey, you moved that thing a few inches today. I really didn't like that.
We just notice everything. It's so funny. I mean, my partner's a doctor, so it's a complementary relationship. Because doctors notice what they need to notice and shut the rest of the world out. But I think it has its plus and minuses. There's stuff about the world that we'd like to turn off, and that's the ability that I think I don't have and would sometimes like to have.
Well, that's what I was just about to ask. It reminds me of Superman in the last movie, where he just had every sound in the world coming into his ears because of his amazing hearing. And it must be like that with your sight, that you notice all these details and would probably like to be able to just put the blinders on sometimes.
I do. And fortunately, you know, I wear glasses, so I can take them off when I go out. If I'm really deep in writing and I don't want more of the world coming in, I'll do errands without my glasses on, and I just won't take in stuff. And it's funny because we have a German Shepherd, and German Shepherds have hearing. That's crazy. And I always feel so bad for her because she gets so stressed out because all of this sound is coming at her and she doesn't know what to do with it. And I think if I didn't have writing as the vehicle that allowed for catharsis to bring what's coming into my brain from the world out onto the page, I don't know. I think I would be pretty much of a nut.
You'd have to lock yourself in a room where there's no surfaces to look at or something.
Exactly.
So the decision to write for younger readers, I mean, had you intended to write for older people as you got older or something, or was it just a niche you found that worked for you?
I write for all ages. I've actually written adult fiction. I write for very young kids. You know, I write picture books. I write middle grade. I write young adult. I write adult. I think I'm most well known for my young adult and middle grade. And in terms of Brown Girl Dreaming, of course, it's about marketing because so many adults have come to me and said, you know, what makes? I understand that the person talking is a young person, but this book spoke volumes to me as, you know, a 50-year-old, as a 60-year-old, as a 35-year-old. So it's been an interesting journey.
Well, yeah. I was going to ask you why it wasn't entered in the poetry category, because we had Mary Shebist in here just this week talking about her National Book Award for Poetry for Incarnadine, and it seems like this would be a logical candidate in that same category.
I don't know. I think there is something that one way I think verse is different from poetry is I think poetry is a little more intentional when it comes to how the poem is shaped on the page. There is a way in which verse is shaped on the page, as I said, with all of that white space around it. And I am paying attention to line breaks and what is said in each line and how what is said becomes a moment in time and very visual. And I think poetry just gives that a little differently. I wouldn't say it's more, they're both very, very thoughtful, but there is a difference. When I read poetry, I read it differently than I read verse.
Okay, we'll get to the distinctions between poetry and verse in just a moment with Jacqueline Woodson. Her book is Brown Girl Dreaming, a memoir in verse. And as we go to the break, let me remind you again, it is the final day of Fall Fund Drive here on Jefferson Public Radio. We're seeking $190,000 in pledges. We're not quite to $134,000 at the moment. A lot of ground to cover. We need you to cover it for us. 888-552-6191 or pledge online at ijpr.org. Back with Jacqueline Woodson and Brown Girl Dreaming in a minute 10. You're back on the Jefferson Exchange on the News and Information Service of Jefferson Public Radio. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thank you for listening. Our guest today is the author Jacqueline Woodson, published many times over, winner of many awards, and now the author of a memoir in verse called Brown Girl Dreaming. It's a 2014 National Book Award finalist for young people's literature. And you can join Jacqueline here on the Jefferson Exchange as we talk about Brown Girl Dreaming. 800-838-3760 is the phone number to call to take part in the conversation. 800-838-3760 or by email jx@jeffnet.org. Okay, so you're in the process of setting me straight, the difference between verse, which is what is going on in Brown Girl Dreaming, and poetry.
Well, I do think that there is a way in which verse put on the page is more linear. So you're reading down, and with each line, you're getting some information, but you kind of need all of it together to have that bang impact that verse gives you. And I think with poetry, you kind of get that line by line, and then you get it all at the same time. And I think there are places in Brown Girl Dreaming where I intentionally do that, say, look at this line, look at this line, look at this line. But for the most part, it's here is a small moment in time. And by the time you get to the end of this moment, you're going to be a little different as a reader.
One relative in particular, I understand, helped you with the memory collection. Actually, as you say, you still kind of live in that space yourself and compartmentalize. But tell us about Aunt Ada and the help she gave you with this book.
My Aunt Ada is a genealogist, and she lives in Ohio. And she's just been holding on to family history and memory and writing stuff down and researching and getting our family's history on this page in the way that allowed me to call her and say, can you tell me about my great-great-grandfather? And she'd go into her office and she'd pull up the file on William J. Woodson, and she would have the information going all the way back. And she was such a lifesaver. And, you know, it's what she loves to do. And it's I just feel so grateful to have relatives who were able to hold on to this history, because historically so many African Americans were not.
That is true, yeah. Having that information at her fingertips is quite a feat. You quickly set the scene for us. You were born right smack in the time of the civil rights struggles of the 1960s. And I want, do you have the book nearby? Would you
yes.
be willing to read either the first or second poem?
Sure thing. February 12, 1963. I am born on a Tuesday at University Hospital, Columbus, Ohio, USA, a country caught between black and white. I am born not long from the time or far from the place where my great-great-grandparents worked the deep, rich land, unfree, dawn till dusk, unpaid, drank cool water from scooped-out gourds, looked up and followed the sky's mirrored constellation to freedom. I am born as the South explodes, too many people, too many years, enslaved, then emancipated, but not free. The people who look like me keep fighting and marching and getting killed so that today, February 12, 1963, and every day from this moment on, brown children like me can grow up free, can grow up learning and voting and walking and riding wherever we want. I am born in Ohio, but the stories of South Carolina already run like rivers through my veins.
That's February 12, 1963, from Brown Girl Dreaming by Jacqueline Woodson. Jacqueline Woodson, our guest here on the Jefferson Exchange. It's really, the technique is marvelous, the way you just shift. I mean, every piece seems to move off into the next one as well to kind of set it up.
Mm-hmm.
And I also notice you share a birthday with Abraham Lincoln.
I do, and Judy Blume.
good company all around.
Yes.
You mentioned Aunt Ada already, and there is quite a bit in here about your family and ancestors, and I couldn't make it out from the book. Did your father end up taking a football scholarship at Ohio State?
He did, but he didn't stay there.
Okay. What was his problem with Ohio State?
He actually got a knee injury. He blew out his knee, and he ended up going into the Air Force.
Oh, okay. You know, my jaw still drops anew when I read some of these, like on the birth certificate mentioned in Second Daughter's Day on Earth. My birth certificate says female Negro.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't know. I still find myself struggling with thinking that there are still people alive who would have those on their birth certificate.
Yeah. And I think there are some that actually say colored. I'm not sure, but this is literally what my birth certificate says and what my mother says. You know, it's what my birth certificate says about who we all were, what race we all were.
I want to jump around just a little bit here because I want to set up your family just a little bit more here. There's a great piece on page 21, Uncle Odell.
Mm-hmm.
Would you mind reading that?
Sure. Not at all, I mean. 6 months before my big sister is born, my Uncle Odell is hit by a car while home in South Carolina on leave from the Navy. When the phone rang in the Nelsonville house, maybe my mother was out hanging laundry on the line, or down in the kitchen speaking softly with her mother-in-law, Grace, missing her own mama back home. Maybe the car was packed and ready for the drive back to Columbus, the place my father called the big city, now their home. But every Saturday morning they drove the hour to Nelsonville and stayed till Sunday night. Maybe right before the phone rang, tomorrow was just another day. But when the news of my uncle's dying traveled from the place he fell in South Carolina to the cold March morning in Ohio, my mother looked out on a gray day that would change her forever. Your brother, my mother heard her own mother say, and then there was only a roaring in the air around her, a new pain where once there wasn't pain, a hollowness where only minutes before she had been whole.
That is some skill there. With a page and a half from Uncle Odell, you make us feel deeply your mother's pain.
Oh, thank you.
Which is quite a feat. But so tell me then, Jackie, when you write this material, is there a fair amount of rough drafting and crossing out and going back, or does it emerge like Mozart with the entire symphony right there on the page?
Oh, my goodness. I stopped counting the revisions at 31. you know, it's interesting. The moments, so many of the moments, like I never got to meet my Uncle Odell because he died just before my sister was born. But there were pictures all around him, and we knew the story. The story was, you know, a part of our fiber, basically, because that's what family history is. You hear the stories over and over, and they become a part of you. So when I started writing Uncle Odell, I knew the emotional core of it. I knew it was about a moment that changed my mother forever. And I knew where she was, and I knew what she was doing, and I knew from my own experience what it means to get that phone call and know that you're completely different now. So there is the restructuring of the verse to get that moment on the page so the reader can feel it. But it what comes in the first jotting down is just the essence of a moment so that me, the writer, can understand it.
Well, Your Brother stands by itself with no connected paragraph, just out there all alone with italics, but the impact is like a fist to the gut.
Mm-hmm.
It's just because, you know, everybody has some sort of story like that they can relate to where you pick up the phone and you hear somebody you know, and they, hi, what's up? And they say, Your Brother.
Yeah.
And then it goes on from there. So it's just very well conveyed. So obviously you're born in Ohio, but ultimately raised in two places. And you don't even remember Ohio, right?
I don't remember Ohio, and this doesn't get into the book until I'm 13, when my mother and father get back together, and that's when I got to meet my relatives and really get a sense of Ohio.
The book is called Brown Girl Dreaming. It's a memoir in verse by Jacqueline Woodson, and it's up for a National Book Award this year. She's a finalist for Young People's Literature. You can join Jackie on the Jefferson Exchange at 800-838-3760. And that's the phone number to call, 800-838-3760. Email address is jx@jeffnet.org if you'd like to take part with us. Your parents had very different feelings about each other's hometowns. That becomes quite clear. I wonder if you could read Night Bus from page 35.
My father arrives on a night bus, his hat in his hands. It is May now, and the rain is coming down. Later, with the end of this rain, will come the sweet smell of honeysuckle. But for now, there is only the sky opening and my father's tears. I'm sorry, he whispers. This fight is over for now. Tomorrow we will travel as a family back to Columbus, Ohio. Hope and Dell fighting for a place on my father's lap. Greenville, with its separate ways, growing small behind us. For now, my parents stand hugging in the warm Carolina rain. No past, no future, just this perfect now.
Well, Night Bus from Jacqueline Woodson from Brown Girl Dreaming. How aware were you, of what was going on between your parents, and B, what was going on between the races in South Carolina at that time?
What was going on between my parents, I wasn't aware at all because I was so young, and only heard the stories growing up from my older brother and sister. The South, I was very aware because I was there until I was 7 years old, and then thereafter, sometimes in the summer. And so I knew because of what my mom and grandma said, because of how they reacted to stuff in the South, what the segregation was, you know, what was happening and how it was impacting people of color. And we lived in a neighborhood called Nickeltown, which was all African-American.
It's the African-American part of Greenville, South Carolina?
Mm-hmm.
And in fact, there's another one that kind of relays what was going on. Can you read At the End of the Day on page 53?
There are white men working at the printing press beside Daddy. I'm sorry, I should preface this. We could call my grandfather Daddy.
Okay, sure.
There are white men working at the printing press beside Daddy, their fingers blackened with ink, so that at the end of the day, palms up, it's hard to tell who is white and who is not. Still, they call my grandfather Gennar, even though he's a foreman and is supposed to be called Mr. Irby. But he looks the white men in the eye, sees the way so many of them can't understand a colored man telling them what they need to do. This is new, too fast for them. The South is changing. Sometimes they don't listen. Sometimes they walk away. At the end of the day, the newspaper is printed. The machines are shut down, and each man punches a clock and leaves. But only colored folks come home to Nickeltown. Here you can't look right or left or up or down without seeing brown people. Colored town, brown town, even a few mean words to say where we live. My grandmother tells us it's the way of the South. Colored folks used to stay where they were told they belonged, but times are changing and people are itching to go where they want. This evening, though, I am happy to belong to Nickeltown.
That piece called At the End of the Day from Jacqueline Woodson's memoir, Brown Girl Dreaming. The whole process of things changing in the South, you were a bit aware of that at the time. And in fact, you make reference in the book to actually seeing some of the whites only and colored only sign painted over, right?
Mm-hmm. They were there for so long. I mean, deep into the 70s. Long after the laws changed, you know, the South just kind of dragged its feet behind in no hurry to create change. And so you did see, you know, a thin layer of water-based paint painted over a sign, but with the letters actually just coming through, which, you know, I don't know how much of that was accidental. So
I don't either, but it certainly did endure. I remember looking at the old train station in Columbus, Georgia in 1987, and you could still see whites only, just barely painted
on. Like a ghost. I mean, it was just kind of this warning that, yeah, this is what the rest of the world is telling us to do, but you better not listen.
You mentioned in another interview you hate doing research. Really?
I don't like research at all. I mean, I love research when it means talking to my Aunt Ada for hours and hours or going back to Greenville and talking to relatives and having dinner and just having the people they knew come alive in the from the past just by, you know, talking about them. Like that kind of human research and the kind that's alive and real feels great to me, but I don't like getting on the internet and having to figure out where I'm going to look and all of that. And of course, at the end of the day, there was great stuff I found. Like, there's a poem, I consider it a poem about Sterling High School, my mother's high school, mm-hmm. burning down. And I knew that it burned down, but I didn't know that they sent the black high school kids into the middle school and crowded them in with their younger sisters and brothers because it was only one black high school in town.
So the whites got the black high school?
No, the black high school got burned down so many of the teens were part of the civil rights movement. So they just burned down their high school. And so the blacks, they weren't going to send them to the white high school.
Oh.
So they sent them to the middle school and made them, you know, be in class with kids much younger because that was the only place they could go.
Does it boggle your mind sometimes? I mean, Strom Thurmond was from South Carolina, wasn't he?
Yeah,
and he was one of the people, I think, who made the comment about, we're not going to let them in this, that, or our swimming pools. It was as if being marinated in water with African-Americans was going to change you somehow.
Yeah, it was, that fear was, you know, I mean, the thing I do understand is fear of the unknown, and it's a heartbreaking fear because it makes people smaller. And, you know, I think that not wanting to go out and experience stuff and see change and let yourself be vulnerable and let yourself be afraid with the hopes of getting stronger through it, that kind of stuff, that really boggles my mind. And the level of hatred, I'm always kind of blown away by that. But, yeah, it was an interesting time. And, you know, I always tell when I talk to young people, especially kids of color, when you look at the history of this country, we came here in chains, and we were not meant to survive. We were meant to work until we died, make some more enslaved people who worked until they died. And that's what we were supposed to do, and we did not do that. You know, we grew up, and we became doctors and lawyers and teachers and presidents. And, you know, and that's what's so amazing, that through all of this hatred, through the history of this country, it didn't break us, you know. It bent us a little, but it definitely didn't break us. And I think that's what my journey in writing Brown Girl Dreaming and showing an earlier book I wrote about my family is. It was coming to understand that here was my mom with four children, part of the Great Migration, leaving and looking for better opportunity in the black community. I don't know if you've heard the phrase, a way out of no way, but looking to make a way out of no way. So,
I mean, it's interesting that you can convey the scenes of the time, but without apparent anger on your own part. I'm talking about, for example, the little girl who was put into the school by court order, and people calling her names.
Ruby Bridges,
adults spitting on her and stuff like that.
A 6-year-old.
Mm-hmm.
And that's why I put that on its own line, that she was 6 years old, because I want the reader to see the moment, you know. So in that piece, it says, it's talking about when I was born, so it says, not even 3 years have passed since a brown girl named Ruby Bridges walked into an all-white school. Armed guards surrounded her while hundreds of white people spat and called her names. So for someone who doesn't know, for the first three lines, they think, okay, maybe this is a teenager and people are, you know.
Right, yeah, so reserve the impact by holding off on six-year-old.
Exactly.
Yeah. Jacqueline Woodson's book is called Brown Girl Dreaming. It's a memoir in verse, and we'll come back and talk more with Jacqueline. On the way to the break, let me remind you once again, it is Fall Fun to Drive Time here on Jefferson Public Radio. $135,304, so $55,000 just about left to raise. We really need your call of support at 888-552-6191, 888-552-6191, or ijpr.org. Back on the exchange in a minute. Final segment on today's Jefferson Exchange. I'm Jeffrey Riley. Thanks for listening. Our guest is Jacqueline Woodson, the author of, many different works. Awards have been won for her works for young adults and younger readers. She's written Hush, Locomotion, After Tupac and Dee Foster, and Beneath a Meth Moon, among others. Brown Girl Dreaming is her memoir in verse of growing up in South Carolina and New York City. It is a 2014 National Book Award finalist in young people's literature, and she'll find out in, I guess, about 3 weeks whether she is, in fact, the winner or not. You can join us here in the Jefferson Exchange, 800-838-3760, anywhere in the listening area, in the Rogue Valley, 541-552-6782. Whoops. Did that automatically. The email address is jx@jeffnet.org. Ignore that second phone number. Jacqueline and I, when we were talking about you hating research, but you did go back to Nickeltown and environs, didn't you, to just sort of get the lay of the land again? And what was that like?
It was humbling. It was definitely so much of what I remembered and so different. Greenville has changed enormously since I was there as a child. But so much of it was the same, even the energy in the pine trees, and so much of what I remembered from my childhood really struck me as how much it had an impact on me and how deeply remembered it was.
There's a interesting poem in here, The Right Way to Speak, on page 68. Mm-hmm. Would you mind reading that? Because it's an interesting demonstration of attitudes about the South within your family.
The first time my brother says ain't, my mother pulls a branch from the willow tree growing down the hill at the edge of our backyard. As she slips her closed hand over it, removing the leaves, my brother begins to cry. The branch is a switch now. No longer beautifully weeping at the bottom of the hill, it whirs as my mother whips it through the air and down against my brother's legs. You will never, my mother says, say ain't in this house. You will never say ain't anywhere. Each switching is a warning to us. Our words are to remain crisp and clear. We are never to say, huh, ain't, or y'all, get, or gonna. Never ma'am, just yes, with eyes meeting eyes enough to show respect. Don't ever ma'am anyone. The word too painful a memory for my mother of not so long ago, Southern subservient days. The list of what not to say goes on and on. You are from the North, our mother says. You know the right way to speak. As the switch raises dark welts on my brother's legs, Dell and I look on, afraid to open our mouths, fearing the South will slip out or into them.
Wow. So your mother was quite adamant about that.
Yeah, she was not playing around.
So, but she was from the South, wasn't she? Just not of the South?
Yes, which, as you know, became a big part of who we were, because we were in the world but not of the world in so many ways. My mom had a Southern accent, but she was extremely well-spoken. And I shouldn't say but. She had a Southern accent, and she was extremely well-spoken. And she really had a thing about language and the importance of it and the power of it.
So, the of the world, but I mean, in the world, but not of the world. Is that also part of being a Jehovah's Witness,
yes,
as you point out in the book, too? Yeah.
Yes, definitely.
Not a lot of Jehovah's Witnesses, I'm thinking, in Nickeltown in those days, but I could be wrong.
There were a lot, and we were related to most of them. No, it was a big congregation.
Huh.
So, now, you know, not just from the Nickeltown area. I mean, we had relatives in Columbia. We had relatives in Aiken and other parts of South Carolina. And so for the General Assemblies, we'd all get together. So.
And you're right of your mother taking part in demonstrations.
Mm-hmm.
How far did that go? What did she get involved in?
The only thing I knew were some of the local Greenville demonstrations. So that, you know, from her early childhood. I mean, from when she was a teenager. And she, it was one of the things that she didn't really like to talk about. So, I think it was because she was still scared, especially when my grandmother was still alive. Like, she was sneaking out. It was kind of not allowed for a lot of the young kids because their parents were so afraid. So.
But there's an interesting description of her putting on her good dress and her white gloves and everything, mm-hmm, as if she was going to go to the movies or something, but that was not the plan.
Yeah, and it was known that it was not the plan. So, and that was actually a story that I heard from my grandmother about my mother.
Did your mother just not talk to you about this stuff? Was that reluctant?
You know, they didn't talk for a really, really, really long time. They didn't talk about a lot of it. And I think it's part of being, you know, part of migrating to this new world of New York City. I think there was a fear of the past, and I think it happens with a lot of immigrant cultures, that you are afraid of bringing whatever hardship you left back on you by speaking of it. And so, you know, they never liked to talk about slavery. They didn't like to talk about, I mean, we would hear stories about the domestic work, but there was a lot of it. It was just talked about in that we're not going into that Woolworth because they have someone who follows people around. Oh, well, you know, you're not going to that pool because they don't treat black people. So it was that constant, this is what we're not doing, but not a whole lot of energy till very, very much later.
All right. So it's not so much of a fighting, constantly angry thing. Just as like, no, we don't go to that Woolworth.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, no.
Yeah, I see the difference. The imagery that you are able to convey is pretty astonishing. I want to get one more in here. Can we read Hair Night from page 83?
Sure. Saturday night smells of biscuits and burning hair. Supper done and my grandmother has transformed the kitchen into a beauty shop. Laid across the table is the hot comb, Dixie Peach hair grease, horsehair brush, parting stick, and one girl at a time. Jackie first, my sister says, our freshly washed hair damp and spiraling over towel shoulders and pale cotton nightgowns. She opens her book to the marked page, curls up in a chair pulled close to the wood-burning stove, bowl of peanuts in her lap. The words in her books are so small I have to squint to see the letters. Hans Brinker are the silver skates, the house at Pooh Corner, Swiss Family Robinson, thick books, dog-eared from the handing down from neighbor to neighbor. My sister handles them gently, marks the pages with torn brown pieces of paper bag, wipes her hand before going beyond the hardbound covers. Read to me, I say, my eyes and scalp already stinging from the tug of the brush through my hair. And while my grandmother sets the hot comb on the flame, heats it just enough to pull my tight curl straighter, my sister's voice wafts over the kitchen, past the smell of hair and oil and flame, settles like a hand on my shoulder and holds me there. I want silver skates like Hans's, a place on a desert island. I have never seen the ocean, but this too I can imagine, blue water pouring over red dirt. As my sister reads, the pictures begin forming as though someone has turned on a television, lowered the sound, pulled it up close. Grainy black and white pictures come slowly at me, deep, infinite, remembered. On a bright December morning long ago, my sister's clear voice opens up the world to me, I lean in, so hungry for it. Hold still now, my grandmother warns. So I sit on my hands to keep my mind off my hurting head and my whole body still. But the rest of me is already leaving. The rest of me is already gone.
That's Hair Night from Jacqueline Woodson's Brown Girl Dreaming. Jacqueline Woodson, obviously our guest on the Jefferson Exchange. Here again, noticing all the details. Have you always been like that, observing all the little things around you?
You know, my mom, when she was still alive, would constantly say, "You don't remember that." And it became kind of a running joke between us because she couldn't understand how I did remember stuff. And or she'd say, "You were too young to remember that." But it kind of, you know, it really confused her and dazzled her that I have so much memory. And it's, you know, bad stuff, too. I have so many lyrics from jingles from the 70s and bad songs and all kinds of stuff like that in my head, too. But it is, there is a way in which, you know, I have a lot of what I've written remembered, a lot from a lot of my books. And it's just how my mind works. I mean, it was how I learned to read and retain information, is by just reading it over and reading it over until it became a part of my memory. So, yeah, in terms of experiences and stuff from my childhood, Hans Brinker or The Silver Skates was a book my sister constantly read. And when we were much younger, we didn't have a lot of books. And we had, once we got to Brooklyn, we got library cards immediately, and we basically lived at the library. But my sister was always very, very careful with how she took care of books, and always, you know, if there was something that needed to be done that was unpleasant, I had to do it first.
Always good having a sister. When, so you find out about the National Book Award the second weekend in November, I guess.
November 19th is the dinner.
Okay. How different is that from other awards you've won? Is this a bigger deal?
This is my third time being a finalist. Mm-hmm. So my daughter, who is 12, keeps asking, "Is this like the Academy Awards? Is this like an Oscar?" You know, I love the fact that I'm a finalist. I love that it's a National Book Honor right now, so it's an honor book, which makes me very, very happy. I get nervous at award ceremonies. You know, I like for them to be over and you find out if you've won or not. But it's also, it's very, very exciting.
All right. Well, we'll be excited for you, and it's been great talking to you today. The book is Brown Girl Dreaming, Jacqueline Woodson. Thank you so much for joining us today in The Exchange.
Thanks again for having me. Take care.
You too.